Good evening and welcome behind the news for July 3, 2003. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. And I've got one interview scheduled for tonight, an interview recorded several weeks ago with the Berkeley geographer Richard Walker, talking about the new economy boom and bust in the San Francisco Bay Area. And then at the bottom of the hour, I'm going to actually read a piece I wrote several months ago in the wake of the November elections about prospects for independent politics in the United States. And the piece is a couple of months old, but I thought that might be worth looking again at this issue with news that I saw the other day that Ralph Nader is considering again a run for the presidency in 2004. And a lot of unanswered questions about that enterprise in 2000. So we will, I'll take, just mull things, some things over and maybe provoke a little controversy, I hope. And then maybe we can take some calls when that's all over. But before we get to all that, a couple of words of on the new economic news. Tomorrow's holiday brought the usual first Friday of the month employment report forward by a day. It was released this morning at 8:30, and there was not much good news hidden in it, or even on the surface of it. Most people, including me, had been expecting a modest rise in the unemployment rate and no change in the count of total employment, the total number of jobs filled by employers across the U.S. Instead, we got a fairly sharp increase in the jobless rate from 6.1 to 6.4%, the highest level since 1994, and a decline of 30,000 in the number of jobs in the whole economy. I should say there are two surveys that go into producing this monthly employment report. One, a survey of about 60,000 households. Another, a survey of about 300,000 employers. These are very, very, very large samples. A lot of people who think that the government is just producing funny numbers know these are really about as good as you can get. And there are certainly some problems of definition. For example, you're not considered unemployed unless you're really actively looking for work. If you've given up the job search as hopeless, you don't count in the registry of the unemployed. And also, if you're employed for just 1 hour, you're counted as employed. So these are rather friendly definitions, to say the least. But once you take these things into consideration, these are extremely good pieces of economic statistics, very rigorous and produced in a very short period of time. And they're the best single snapshot we got of the state of the economy, both in the broad macroeconomic sense, but also in the human sense, since it measures whether people are working or not, and if they are working, how much they're being paid. So these are very good numbers, and anybody who says they're not, don't take them too seriously. And as I said, the unemployment rate rose to 6.4%, but it's always salutary to take a look behind those averages and take a look at some demographic groups to see how they're faring. Men's unemployment rate for adult men was 6.1%, for adult women, 5.2%. For teenagers, though, it was significantly higher, around 20%. For white adults, the unemployment rate was 5.5%. For black adults, 11.8%, almost 12%, more than twice as high as the rate for whites. For teenagers, black teenagers, 39% unemployment rate. That is a truly phenomenal number. The unemployment rate for the whole economy peaked out at about 25% during the Great Depression of the 1930s. So for most black teenagers, every day is like a Great Depression. For Latinos, adults, unemployment rate of 8.4%. And a great variation by educational level. For those people who didn't finish high school, their unemployment rate was close to 10%. For people with a bachelor's degree or higher, the unemployment rate was 3%. So a lot of variations under the surface of that 6.4% average. But there was no strength hidden anywhere below the headline numbers. Sometimes at turning points in the economy, you'll see some internal contradictions or portents of better times to come. For example, an increase in the share of industrial sectors adding jobs despite an overall decline, or a lengthening of the average work week. Sometimes that portends hiring down the road. Not this time. Most industries shed jobs, and the work week was unchanged. The only positive was a rise in temporary employment, which has historically suggested increases in broad employment several months down the road. But it's possible there's been a structural change in the economy with employers relying more on temp workers and more shy of making permanent commitments than ever. So that indicator may not be working this time around. Further, last month's employment numbers were revised downwards. There are several iterations of these employment figures. They're released early in the month following the month concern. For example, we just this morning learned the numbers for June, but then May's numbers were revised, April numbers were revised, and then these are going to be revised again over the next couple of years. But still, last month's initial report was for a decline of 17,000 jobs in May. That was expanded now to an estimate of 70,000 job losses. Services were initially reported to show a small increase. Now they've been revised to a small loss. The manufacturing sector is nothing short of a disaster. That lost another 56,000 jobs in June, the 35th consecutive month, almost 3 years now, of declines in manufacturing, the longest by far on record. And monthly statistics go back to 1939, so we're talking about a pretty long record here. The 35-month consecutive decline is more than twice as long as the streak we saw during the Rust Belt recessions of the early 1980s. And the percentage job loss in the factory sector is greater now than it was over 20 years ago. So manufacturing, an important sector despite rumors to the contrary, is just bleeding jobs like crazy. We've now seen five consecutive months of overall job losses. We've never seen such a streak outside formal recessions. And it's usually assumed by most analysts that the recession that began in early 2001 ended some time ago, though it's never been officially declared over. We've even had some recessions in which there weren't five back-to-back months of job decline. So this is a pretty bad performance, and even though a lot of economic indicators are flat to slightly up, the job market is in pretty bad shape. This record, this performance, deepens my suspicions that this has not been a textbook business cycle decline all along, but a much more serious bout of economic trouble, a longer-term issue than the usual ups and downs of the boom and bust cycle. We've had some ideas that we might be experiencing something like what has been seen in Japan over the last decade or so, a real structural stagnation, and this is further evidence that something like that may be happening here, a post-bubble stagnation. About that unemployment rise, the one bit of good news in that number was that it was a result of new people entering the workforce, workers re-entering after an absence, and people voluntarily quitting their jobs. The number of people actually involuntarily losing their jobs was off a bit in June. But that's about the only good news in the release. Wage growth has slowed to a crawl, as you might expect in such a slack labor market. Several other bits of news came out this morning. First of all, the report of claims for unemployment insurance, which is released every Thursday morning. The first-time claims, the count of first-time claims, people who just lost their jobs visiting unemployment insurance, unemployment offices and filing their applications for the first time, that rose by more than 21,000 last week, far more than most economists were expecting. And the number continuing to draw benefits also rose to almost 3.8 million. So the bottom line is that the rate of job loss has apparently slowed, but there's little new hiring going on. People are still spending money on housing, cars, and gadgets, that is, people who still have jobs. But unless there's a pickup in employment soon, there's going to have to be some kind of retrenchment on the demand side. So the next couple of months could be crucial. Another piece of news this morning, the Institute for Supply Management regularly surveys purchasing managers, that is the people who buy things for corporations. They're very in tune with the state of business. They're the ones who buy inputs and office supplies and all kinds of things like that. So they're very on top of whether times are good or bad. And their trade association surveys them regularly. They do one survey of manufacturers, and more recently they started doing a survey of the service industries. And the manufacturing numbers have been quite terrible and remain quite terrible, but the service industries are picking up a bit. Almost 61% of those surveyed reported an improvement in their business, up from 55% last month. And this is at least one hopeful sign that there may be some pickup in the service sector, although it's not showing up yet in the payroll numbers. But to get a serious recovery going in the U.S. economy, we need a recovery in capital expenditures, that is, companies buying equipment, computers and lathes and building new factories and warehouses and offices. And we're not seeing this. And it's unlikely that we're going to see any kind of pickup in this with almost 30% of our industrial capacity now lying idle. So it seems that capital expenditures are in a similar situation as the job market. Employers are very reluctant. Managers are very reluctant to hire, very reluctant to hire to invest. And their general mood seems to be one of fear, uncertainty, and doubt. And finally, a word about the Medicare drug benefit package that has been working its way through Congress. I think the two houses have passed something, but they haven't come to a common agreement yet. This is being hailed widely as good news, which it is at first sight, that seniors will get some help from Medicare to pay for prescription drugs. But under the surface, it looks like a plan to force seniors into HMOs and other kinds of managed care schemes. This looks like a step towards privatizing Medicare. Little attention is being paid to that. It's a little hard to find a pre-holiday guest to talk about this issue, but I'll make an effort in the next week or two to get somebody to talk about what's going on with the drug benefit and the possible privatization of Medicare. So enough of me. Let's listen now to an interview I recorded several weeks ago. I was at a conference in Minneapolis on the so-called new economy, which is also the subject of a book that I just finished writing, which will appear from the New Press this fall. It's called After the New Economy, and I will tell you more about it as the time approaches. But I also recorded this interview with a fellow conference attendee, Richard Walker, who is a professor of geography at the University of California, Berkeley. Geography has come a long way since it was all about mountains and borders and physical things like that. It's increasingly a social science and an economic science. That is how class and production and all kinds of economic and social activities are constructed across space. And we're used to hearing about how the economy is doing broadly, and even how individual industrial sectors are doing, but there's also wide variations in how different places are doing, and this is one of the things that geographers study, and this is certainly one of the things that Richard Walker looks at, and he has been studying very carefully what happened in the California economy, particularly the area around the San Francisco Bay, during the boom of the 90s and the bust of the early aughts. And I recorded this interview with Dick Walker talking about just that, what the boom and bust looked like from his vantage point in San Francisco and Berkeley. Dick Walker.
Welcome to WBAI, Dick Walker. We're accustomed to hearing about the boom of the 90s, but it was very unevenly spread across the distribution of income, but also across the across space, as you geographers say.
That's right.
Give us a quick overview of the hotspots of the boom and the subsequent bust.
Well, of course, I think the ground zero of the boom was the San Francisco Bay Area because of Silicon Valley and the dot-com boom in San Francisco. And the new economy and financial bubble met somewhere in San Francisco and Silicon Valley and completely transformed the city and, to some extent, laid waste to it.
All right, well, let's put some flesh on those bones. Silicon Valley, exactly, we know electronics, but that's not the whole story. So, and there's a whole bunch of ancillary supportive industries. So who's who in this whole of the Silicon Valley?
Well, Silicon Valley, of course, its base is electronics, but it had morphed in the 1980s into computers and then into software and then finally into the Internet, providing both hardware and software and the whole complex. And there was this sort of tongue of Silicon Valley that reached into San Francisco, which was originally called Multimedia Gulch, where electronics, Hollywood, and the arts community and the commerce community of San Francisco all came together in this moment, starting with publishing and video games and special effects for Hollywood, but then morphing into the Internet madness of e-commerce and the webbies. So San Francisco became even the most volatile piece of this because it was the e-commerce part. It was the web part, the dot-coms, in fact.
What was Multimedia Gulch before it was that?
Well, they'd been working on all these kind of this marriage of the visual arts with electronics, whether it was for Hollywood or whether it was for web pages or whether it was for video games. It was a whole array of things. And then also San Francisco, it had this publishing center with Macworld and a series of things, and it became the place where Wired and Red Herring and the Industry Standard, these journals of the new age, of the new dot-com age, came into being. And so they were major proselytizers for the new economy, the new age, the wonders of the Internet that would never cease. And down in Silicon Valley, of course, you had the main venture capitalist, led by John Doerr of Kleiner Perkins. And he was really the guy who had invented the notion of the new economy and said famously that Silicon Valley was the greatest wealth-creating machine in the history of the world.
And now it's become a wealth destruction machine in the last couple of years.
It has indeed. When the dot-com bubble burst, when the NASDAQ bubble burst, it left San Francisco Bay Area on its knees.
What did longtime residents of the area, how did they greet this transformation?
Well, a lot of them were appalled because it was a whole set of new people rushing in, a lot of young people rushing in. And it wasn't even, in the late 90s, it wasn't even the old techie culture of Silicon Valley, which had its own aspects of the nerds and the entrepreneurs and so on. But it had morphed into this commercial culture that was much shallower, much even more greedy and aggressive. And especially in San Francisco, you felt kind of the pulse of this. And old-line San Franciscans viewed these people as with a jaundiced eye. Now, I think to some extent unfairly, but they were also the victims of this incredible real estate market that drove prices through the roof. And so a lot of people, particularly Latino people in the Mission District and artists who had been in the Loft District, south of Market, the old warehouses district that was taken over by the dot-coms, they really felt the pressure. A lot of them were pushed out of San Francisco.
But there are also links between the Bay Area and Wall Street and sort of other areas of tech finance concentration. Could you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, San Francisco has historically been the financial center of the West, despite some illusions on the part of people in Los Angeles. And it's very tightly connected with New York. And it had actually invented this new form of finance called venture capital. That was done in Silicon Valley, going back all the way to the 60s, but particularly developing in the 70s and 80s. Venture capital being this kind of risk-seeking finance that would invest in high-risk startups in high-tech, or some of them were in retail and medical and so on, but concentrated in high-tech electronics. And okay, so venture capital exploded up to $40 billion, and the Bay Area was getting about a quarter of that, which is a huge chunk. And then, in addition, the Bay Area was involved with the IPO madness of the 90s. The first great IPO of that era was Netscape in 1995 with Jim Clark and John Doerr of Kleiner Perkins putting it together. And when that took off and the price, you know, went to the moon and you had all these dozens of instant millionaires, maybe hundreds, that's when the madness really starts around the new Internet age, which has just kind of become possible as a mass communication and mass commercial outlet in the mid-90s. Then there were some additional things like Charles Schwab invented discount brokering and had undercut the old brokerage firms and turned discount marketing into this mass phenomenon, which helped drive the bubble. And E-Trade, of course, came online in the 90s where you could do that through your through the computers and through the internet, and then Schwab did it at an even higher level.
There was a sort of, at least in the early days, this very utopian quality to it all. This is going to be a revolution that would change the way we do everything. Everything has been transformed in a really wonderful way. And there were people like Stuart Brand from the Whole Earth Catalog who could, what was former hippie became, you know, the with the electronics era. How did the culture of the Bay Area contribute to this this boom?
Well, yeah, Stuart Brand, it's good to mention him. I think it, you know, it has this kind of longstanding countercultural and even utopian attitude, and especially utopian towards technology. So it's kind of where the counterculture meets the American technological sublime. And then you pump a lot of money in that with the financial bubble, and people really lost their senses. So, yeah, not only did you have John Doerr proclaiming the new economy, but you had all these magazines, the Wired people, people communicating in this website called The Well, who felt they were inventing the new age, and they were bringing it to the benighted masses. And on the one hand, there were those who were really pushing the utopia of the internet as a kind of people's democratic, revolutionary technology. And of course, in some ways, it has that aspect, but they tended to go over the top, because they believed each other and they talked to each other. And then down in Silicon Valley, you had John Dornall pushing, you know, the money-making, financial, capitalist aspects of this, saying, look, you know, this is a money-making machine that will never end. Recessions are over. This is the new age. And they pushed this very, very hard. Peter Schwartz, who'd been an old friend of Stuart Brand, wrote a book about how we would never have another recession. And there was a lot of this madness coming out. People really believed it in the way people on Wall Street believed that the Dow could go to 30,000.
Yeah, 36,000 actually was the title of a famous book, but there was also a 40,000 and a 100,000, three books, each one topping.
Well, see, being in the West Coast, I missed how that topped off.
But now that's all a fading memory. So what was it left behind?
Yeah, you don't hear so much talk of the new economy anymore. And when the NASDAQ bubble burst in April of 2000, of course, it was felt on the West Coast first. And, you know, NASDAQ had moved to New York, but it had actually been invented also by the Silicon Valley technology guys as their stock exchange alternative, you know, where you would use their technology to trade against the old-fashioned system. Anyway, after the bubble burst, within the first year or so, there was a little article hidden away in the San Francisco Chronicle about how San Francisco firms had lost $2 trillion of their value, the Bay Area firms. And that was, at that time, out of the $4.5 trillion that had been lost on all the stock markets. So I figure in that first year, especially when the NASDAQ bubble left and burst and led the way down, the Bay Area was represented about 40% of the stock loss, which is just astounding for this place that has about 7 million people. I mean, it's a big place, but it's in terms of the whole United States, it represents maybe 2%, not 40%.
You alluded to this earlier, but there was some resistance, especially around the Mission, people in San Francisco resisting the gentrification, the real estate boom and all. Could you talk about that a bit?
Yeah, of course, it's important to say the real estate boom was triggered by the stock boom and by the amounts of money people had in their hands suddenly. Plus, of course, the financial institutions were happy to lend to this upper-end market that was expanding. And we had, you know, multiple million-dollar houses selling all over. Palo Alto became the most expensive housing market in the United States, just in miniature. And larger, the Bay Area became both the richest area in terms of per capita income and also the highest median house prices by far. And the median house price edged up during the bubble to $500,000, which is really extraordinary. So
some of these are not really grand houses either.
Oh, no, absolutely not. I mean, these are little bungalows often. The grand houses were going for $16 million or something. So this put enormous pressure on some of the older housing areas, as well as some of the more alternative housing areas in the old industrial part of town, which quickly switched over to dot-com rehabs down in the warehouses. And then you've got a lot of the young dot-comers were buying into these lofts, which were in the industrial areas, but were actually these kind of high techno-modern condos selling for $750,000. So this started to put a lot of pressure on the Mission District, on what bits of the old working class were left south of the market, and then across the city, really. The apartment rents just went through the roof. There was a moment there where commercial rents in San Francisco shot past Manhattan in late 99, early 2000. And apartment rents, I don't know the exact comparison, but where they were right up there. And so that was driving literally driving people out of town, and there was quite a response to that. It's interesting because a lot of us have felt that with slowly increasing prices, with the dot-com invasion, that maybe the old left and the counterculture in San Francisco had been driven out, had been driven to the wall. It had really just become a luxury city. A lot of people felt that. And there's a very good book on this, by the way, Hollow City by Rebecca Solnit from Verso Press. I recommend it. But in the end, it turned out there was quite a lot of radical energy left. And there was quite an upheaval against the political order, against the planning board, and, of course, its mentor, which was Mayor Willie Brown. And in the end of 2000, in the elections of 2000, in the runoff elections for supervisor, which is our city council, basically, pretty much all the Willie Brown people were driven out of office and replaced by these pretty radical community organizing people who'd been mobilized by the dot-com bubble.
And now, what's left?
Well, what's left is, in terms of the real estate bubble, of course, there's a lot of empty space. San Francisco's commercial real estate is running at about one-fifth to one-quarter empty. Rentals have fallen dramatically in commercial space, and even in apartments, they're falling like a stone. You now have, you know, landlords begging people to come, whereas before, you literally had to give them stock options in your new company to move in. And so the housing market looks a lot better for people, and some people have held on by the skin of their teeth, and a lot of the Latino community in the Mission has been held on and been protected by some changes in the planning rules. So things are looking a lot better for the people, except, of course, with the bubble bursting, all this empty space, there's a lot of unemployment. Down in Silicon Valley, it's even worse. They've lost upwards of 200,000 jobs out of roughly 750,000 in the area. And their empty space is running at 28%, which is just astronomical.
After they built a lot of new space.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Silicon Valley now has, I think, 234 million square feet of commercial industrial space. It's what they call R&D space. It can be used alternatively for offices and industry.
Kind of curious about the planning apparatus. Is there, I'm sort of aware of that kind of way the real estate industry and the city government in New York do the long-term planning of land use planning. But how does that work in the Bay Area? And do you have all these separate jurisdictions?
Well, yeah, of course, we're much more fragmented, which is not necessarily a virtue by any means. But you saw it mostly in San Francisco, where these were very contested changes of planning rules to allow, you know, lofts, which had been artist spaces, to be converted willy-nilly into mass housing, and where warehouses and industrial activities that were, you know, the last remnants of industrial San Francisco were really being pushed out by rezoning. They couldn't hold their ground because they couldn't pay competitive rents. And the city wasn't willing to give them any protection whatsoever and was happy to see them go, in fact, under the Brown administration. And Brown, you know, appointed a bunch of pro-real estate people to the planning commission in his planning department, and they were just greasing the skids for all this. So politically, you know, Willie Brown is a very interesting character. He's a Clintonian Democrat, very similar. He's a man of the people. He's incredibly smart, incredibly good political operator who is deeply in bed with the capitalist.
So what's their plan? Do they have a plan for recovery, or are they just hoping that things will take care of themselves?
I don't see much plan. There's been there's been some rezoning of industrial space to residential so they could build some more housing, because the housing market is still, especially the ownership housing market, is still very, very high because of the post-bubble bubble of low interest rates on mortgages. So there's some of that. Now, down in Silicon Valley, I know they're resisting that because they're afraid they'll lose industrial space. And they understand that they're still an industrial center in the way San Francisco does not.
There's still actual manufacturing going on in the Valley.
Oh, yeah. The Valley still has quite, I would say, about a quarter to a third of the workers in Silicon Valley electronics are actually production workers still. And people don't see that, but they're doing working with the R&D people to do demonstration products, you know, initial issue, and special contract products.
And the mass production is often Asia.
Mass production, of course, is in Asia. But you have to remember that the three of the four firms that do the contract manufacturing, because it's all done by contract now, you know, Apple and Sun and Cisco, they don't actually make anything in their mass products at all. It's all contracted to Selectron and Sanmina, SMI, and these. Those guys are all headquartered in Silicon Valley. So there's still an understanding of what production is and manufacturing. And like I say, a lot of the specialty work is still done in the Valley with a lot of very low-wage, mostly Asian Latino labor.
And how does this low-wage contingent survive in this very high-rent, high-expense neighborhood?
Yeah, that's an excellent question, and not often asked. And they don't survive very easily. I mean, and this is true, by the way, also of workers who are ancillary to the industry, like school teachers. And they have special programs now in the Valley to give mortgage subsidies to school teachers and others like that who are, you know, policemen, firemen who can't afford to live there. So what's happening is a lot of those people you either double up. And if you go down in the Latino areas, it's like what happened in L.A. in the 80s. There's tens of thousands of people living in garages, or they're jammed, you know, one extended family in an apartment, you know, 20 people living in a two-bedroom apartment. Or they're moving out, and they're living out in the Central Valley, or they're living down in Salinas, these agricultural areas where you can get a house for maybe $200,000 and drive in. But, of course, you spend 2 to 3 hours of your day in a car.
For your $7-an-hour job.
Yeah. So it's very, very hard. You can't sustain that too well.
And this was all just under the surface? This never became an explicit political crisis?
The remaining labor movement in the Valley has tried to make this an issue, has drummed at it, and has had some success under Amy Dean at the Central Labor Council. They've taken the view that a lot of these community issues, health and housing, are ones where you can make more progress than you can in direct plant organizing, which is so very hard because the electronics industry has been absolute lockdown non-union for years, and several attempts to organize have been utter failures because the industry has been so antagonistic and so successfully. So she took the view that to organize through the community to try and give labor a political presence in the community. She's actually been extremely successful with that. And she's made alliances with environmentalists, with even with industry itself, to try and get more dense housing, you know, infill housing, what they call smart growth these days, in the Valley to densify it. And actually, what's happened, both because of the market and because of political efforts like that by the city, you know, by a number of forces, Silicon Valley's become very, very dense. And people don't know it. And New Yorkers may be surprised to hear, but in the 2000 census, the densest metropolitan area in the country is now Los Angeles, and the second densest is the Bay Area, including Silicon Valley.
Finally, has Silicon Valley lost any of its usual swagger and optimism?
Yeah, absolutely. You feel that the bloom is off right now. Now, it'll probably come back because they're working night and day on nanotechnology and other new possibilities for yet another wave of growth. But they have to come up with something, and they know it. And that's been their key to success in the past, is inventing the next revolution. How long they can do that is anybody's guess. But right now, yeah, there's a sense of retrenchment. There's all the figures journalists have guessed at are maybe 35, 40,000 young people have left the entrepreneurial mix. The older guys are kind of more in charge, a little less entrepreneurism and more let's get serious about the bottom line. I think Carly Fiorina, Hewlett-Packard, represents that in spades. You know, it's about cost-cutting and marketing mass goods against Dell instead of innovation in this period.
That's what Steve Jobs said, something that the industry needs grown-up supervision.
Yeah, I think Steve Jobs has morphed himself into a serious middle-aged capitalist in this regard. And that, you know, his alliance with the music industry is probably indicative of that, too, where he's saying, okay, yeah, we don't want to be irresponsible. Don't burn stuff now. Pay your 99 cents per piece of music. And he's trying to cut a deal to give Apple a big a niche in this market by going hand-in-hand, you know, smooching with the music industry, trying to clamp down on the kids who are copying MP3s.
So much for the revolution.
So much for the revolution, yeah.
Thanks, Dick Walker.
Thank you.
And that was indeed Richard Dick Walker, who is a professor of geography at Berkeley, speaking with me, Doug Henwood, in Minneapolis in a lovely Holiday Inn near the University of Minnesota campus several weeks ago when we were both at a conference there. And I think I'm a little late saying this is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. On the radio dial and at WBAI.org on the World Wide Web. And be sure to check out that website. Lots of good stuff on there all the time. And we'll be back in a moment with a little polemic for me after this word from Chicks on Speed.
Hi, my name is Julie. I like Mac power books and electronic music.
Wanna be the ruler of the galaxy.
Wanna be the king of the universe.
Let me even have a baby.
No.
Wanna be the empress of fashion.
Wanna be the president of Moscow.
Let me even have a baby.
No.
A song, bit from a song for a future generation by the multinational trio Chicks on Speed, who are three women based in Germany, although they had a little male assistance on that track. And I saw in an article in USA Today the other day saying that Ralph Nader is thinking of running for president again in 2004, and which reminded me of this piece that I wrote shortly after the November election last year, when Republicans did rather well. And certainly everything that's happened since has not been terribly encouraging, with Bush riding high in the polls and Republicans running riot all over the place. And it made me think that it might be a good time to revisit this issue. So this is a little out of date, though I sort of updated it as I was reading it on the fly. But it was a piece I published in the newsletter I edit, Left Business Observer, and I just hope it will provoke some thoughts and start a conversation. I certainly don't have any answers, as you can tell from the ending of this, but I thought it worth thinking about just what we hope to accomplish with independent politics and how, and how we might actually affect political discourse and political activity in this country. You know, sometimes it seems like the Democrats are hopeless. Sometimes it seems like they're the best we can do. What's it all mean? This is a me reading something that I wrote several months ago, but I think still seems to raise some lively and important issues.
The mess we're in. After the maniac Republican sweep of 1994, LBO quoted Murray Kempton's observation that it probably meant the demise of the Democrats, since they had nothing to their name but incumbency. Clinton's re-election 2 years later and his subsequent high approval ratings made Kempton's prognosis look excessively gloomy. But after last November's election and the subsequent behavior of Bush in the polls, it looks once again that Kempton had a serious point. It's easy to diss the Dems for their lack of spine, but that character critique overlooks the party's structural role as an institution loyal to capital that sometimes has to pretend otherwise to appeal to its base. That's not to say that the parties are identical, two cheeks of the same derriere, as Christopher Hitchens, George Bush's latest fan, put it a few years ago. They're not. Democrats in Congress are more likely to support unions and reproductive freedom and to oppose free trade deals and reactionary judicial nominees than are Republicans. Clinton appointed far more tolerable people to the National Labor Relations Board than Bush has and ever will. But Clinton also got NAFTA through, ruined prospects for a sensible public health care financing system, had his Treasury secretaries roam the world prying open capital markets, and presided over one of the great profit and asset inflations in world history. And if the Dems are doomed to fade, as Kempton argued, what then? Which is where the argument for independent politics usually comes in. But that seems harder to make than ever now. Most third-party enthusiasts want to efface the difference between D and R, arguing that either there's none at all or none that really matters. Speaking of Western Europe, as well as the U.S., cultural theorist Slavoj Žižek has argued that the best time to make the argument that there's no difference between the two major parties is when the more liberal one is in power, because when the right-wingers are in control, it's too obviously untrue. Žižek may be right. The Republican Party is frightening. Trent's lot mistake in praising Strom Thurmond last year was in his honesty. He revealed what Žižek has called the hidden underside of his ideology. Nods, winks, and code words are fine, but letting the cat all the way out of the bag can cause difficulties. Though there are principled anti-racists on the right, the Republican Party as an organization depends upon covert racist appeals, and much of the anti-lot bleeding by his colleagues was designed to shroud the rudely exposed underside and not to exorcise it. As obnoxious as the Democrats can be, they're not that obnoxious. Those of us who supported Ralph Nader in 2000, including me, have to do some rethinking. That's not to concede that Nader's candidacy drew away enough votes to elect Bush. That's not true, and not merely because Gore won the popular vote. The number of Democrats who voted for Bush was far greater than Nader's vote, and Gore's dismal campaign blew what should have been a Democratic landslide. The rethinking is more about long-term political strategies, something about which the Nader campaign bothered little. Where is Ralph? The theory of his candidacy, and not his own since he's allergic to theory, but one offered by many of his supporters, was that it was part of an effort to build the Green Party and an alternative political movement larger than electoral politics. Little of this has happened. Though there are some bright spots here and there, the Green Party is mostly an embarrassment, having failed even to keep ballot status in New York State and having nominated a ludicrous candidate in the Minnesota Senate race. The National Green Party platform has its moments, but it's a frequently embarrassing document, a laundry list with little sense of coherence or priority. Things have not been going well with the Greens. But it's not just in the U.S. It's been disturbing to watch Lula's government in Brazil. Unlike Nader and the Greens, Lula's victory came from a long organizing campaign by the Workers' Party. It was a movement and not a letterhead nor an ad hoc coalition. Lula was elected as a repudiation of the neoliberal economics that has left Brazil and most of its neighbors with lots of debt and no sign of the promised prosperity. But the government he's been running is almost thoroughly orthodox. His finance minister promised a fiscal policy that was the most austere possible and has delivered on his promise. The head of the central bank's last job was as working for a U.S. Commercial bank. The guy at the Agriculture Ministry has defended the right of landowners to take up arms against landless squatters. Is it right to scream sellout, or is it better to look at the structural reasons for such rightward turns, and not just in Brazil? The ANC in South Africa and the Greens in Germany come to mind, too. Clearly, there's something about taking power in itself that turns former radicals into moderates or conservatives. Pressures from domestic and foreign capital markets, of allaying the suspicious fears of the middle classes, of managing the technostructure to assure that the electricity keeps running. American independent politicians seem to focus on purity of intention. The right people with the right platform can do the job, with little sense of how conservatizing proximity to power can be. As one skeptic has put it, would a Green in Congress behave all that differently from Nancy Pelosi? But surely this is all too pessimistic. Radical change has happened in the past, and no doubt will happen again in the future. One hope would be concentrating on building independent institutions, which weren't slavish subsidiaries of the more liberal party, rather than running chimerical electoral campaigns. Existing Naderite politics, which has a lot in common with mainstream American Lone Ranger individualism, thinks differently. As Thomas Berkey, author of Lawyers, Lawsuits, and Legal Rights, who I've interviewed in this program, by the way, as he argues, Nader prefers litigation to regulation because regulation creates bureaucracies that can be captured by the very industries that they regulate, while litigations involve juries, entities that dissolve upon delivering the verdict and which are made up of ordinary people with no vested interest in the outcome. It's conceptually strange that social policies should be set by people with no interest in outcomes. Isn't politics all about struggle among interested parties? Policy by litigation is scattershot. The U.S. judicial system is massively fragmented by a geography and jurisdiction, and only a small minority of injured parties ever sue. And such strategies leave no institutional residue. But that's fine with Ralph, and to lots of mainly youthful protesters, to whom bureaucracy is an abomination, and which never can be domesticated or democratized. And so too with this chimerical campaign, which has left no institutional residue either. Some institutions have to be bureaucratic. It'd be impossible to run an industrial economy or anything larger than a block association without one, but not all. The protests that now accompany every elite meeting have spawned all kinds of institutions and networks, which helped a pretty healthy anti-war movement grow pretty quickly late last year and early this. We urgently need more of this, institutions that live apart from the temptations and constraints of state power, and that can scare the bad guys and make the good ones a bit more faithful to their promises on the rare occasion they win office. Yes, but this would be the place for the rousing finale, the call to action, and the hopeful prognosis. But that would be a forced conclusion. Surely all these independent institutions and flexible networks of rebellion are essential and inspiring. But what about state power? Are the corruptions of power too dangerous even to flirt with it? Is it a mistake to run for office and try to govern? Should we follow the models of the Zapatistas, don ski masks, and forswear the state? Or is radical social change impossible without capturing the state? Not sure, really.
And that was me, on recording, although I did it earlier today, wondering about independent politics and just how deeply involved one should get in the state. And anyone who has any thoughts on this or any issues, we've got some few minutes remaining. Please give us a call, 212-209-2900, 212-209-2900, and talk things over. Anyone want to talk about the wisdom of independent politics or the state of the economy or whatever else is on your mind? We see. Got some blinking lights here, so let's take a call. Welcome to WBAI. You're on the air. Hello?
Oh, how are you? Listen to your commentary?
Sure. Go ahead.
The big fallacy and the big lie that Nader told was that the Republicans and Democrats are the same. Because in essence, they are. They both, you know, eat stuff from the same corporate trough, and they basically work the same way. One is a little more reactionary than the other. Because the Bush people are not Republicans. They're not conservatives. They're not libertarians. They're not Greens. They're fascists. Nader failed to understand this. I don't know why. Bush showed his true colors years ago, which is how his father operated and how Reagan operated and how those people operated in Iran-Contra. They're the same folks.
Well, I think Nader and certainly a lot of other people, including me, thought that Bush Jr. would be a little bit more like his father. He was sort of a traditional Eisenhower Republican. He wasn't too insanely right-wing, but now we've got an insanely repressive right-wing reactionary government.
No, but he was, and if the media would have reported the fact that he was deserted during the Vietnam War, if he was an inside traitor, if he destroyed the Texas economy, and on and on and on, he wouldn't have been elected. You know, the media completely dropped the ball for a variety of reasons.
All right, well, thanks for your comments.
You're welcome.
We've got a short period of time and more people on the queue here. So welcome to WBA on the air.
Yes, the idea of trying to take someone like Dennis Kucinich, who's reasonably left, and try to use some of his ideas to push something like the Green Party, convincing people like Dennis Kucinich's people to get him to run also in the Green Party line. Because after the election, you need to have some type of apparatus to keep going. And the Democrats will probably do what they would do with Susan McKinney, Cynthia McKinney in Georgia, get rid of her. Only reason why Barbara Lee is still functioning in Berkeley is because she has a strong progressive group of Democrats behind her. And we need to do something about party building, not just talking to each other.
Well, right, and also chasing after celebrities like Ralph Nader, and then who do nothing to build any kind of institution after he's off the scene.
You know, Ralph Nader, Jesse Jackson, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. All right, thanks for your comments. We've got lots of other people in the line here, so welcome to WBAI. You're on the air. Oops, there we go. All right, let's try again. Welcome to WBAI. You're on the air. Ah, hello. Hello. Oops. We're losing him. Some space if anyone wants to call 212-209-2900, but let's now take this call. Hello?
Hi. You know, I think more political parties would be the way to go. Why not start a political party in New York over the issues that people in New York are facing? You know, if you don't like the Green Party, could start another political party in a neighborhood. Just have some activity on the street, have some thinking going on, and decide what you're going to do on a local level. That wouldn't affect, you know, the presidential race. You know, when Nader runs, he doesn't have the base, you know. The real base hasn't been established yet, so it can flip the election to Bush. But, for instance, in 1896, the Progressive Party took over the Democratic Party and nominated Bryan. He almost won the election, from what I understand. But there was a long build-up to that. There were ideas, you know, that were promulgated by the Progressive Party and, you know, the farmers and the industrial unionists. And that sort of a process needs to start somewhere. So I think people, you know, maybe could discuss what are the issues we're facing in New York. Why not create our own political party just based in New York City? You know, and start some kind of activity, you know, visible activity that deals with people on the street, you know.
All right, well, thank you for your comments. I think we need to have this conversation, and we're almost out of time, but let's see if we can get one more call in. A lot of people waiting here. Welcome to WBAI. You're on the air.
Yes, Astra. You know, there's three things I'm going to say fast. First of all, people with asthma, children with asthma there, people that saw the World Trade Center go down, they should apply for SSI, mentally disabled, because of that, or Medicaid, or disability, Social Security disability. And also, as far as the computer industry goes, I called a reporter up there at the Associated Press a couple weeks ago, and she told me that the Army has a computer that when you talk into it, it'll type out. Now, one thing else, CBS Television, a black newscaster on there about a month or two ago, said that we use computers up here at CBS, but a medical study has shown they cause tunnel syndrome in the hands, brain disease, heart disease, and leg disease unless you move around. So I think that's what the government's going to do. They're going to produce this computer that stops all these disability cases on the computer.
All right. Well, we'll have to make that the last call because we're out of time. Thanks for all of you for calling. And sorry, we couldn't get to more of you. This is a conversation worth having over the very long term, because I don't think any of the received formulas are working very well, and we just don't know how to get out of this the mess we're in, to paraphrase Trent Lott from last year. So we're just about out of time. Stay tuned for the news and on to the evening. This is Doug Henwood. I'll be back next week, and let's go out with a little bit more from Chicks on Speed.
Hey, I'm Alex, and I'm a Taurus. I love tomatoes and black cat chickadees.
Hi, I'm Jennifer. I really like biking in the park, and I like, oh, I have all these friends.
La, 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 la.
Hi, my name is Pelham, and I'm a Pisces. I love computers and hot tamales.
Wanna be the captain of the Enterprise?
Wanna be the king of the studios?
Let me and have a baby.